Wendy's Coffee House. The book, the first one, Incident at Devil's Den, was about an abduction experience. Now there's a second book, and this is Devil's Den, The Reckoning. And it's not just the experience, it's the lifelong encounters remembered.
I never had any intention of telling anyone about this or sharing it with anyone. When I saw those x-rays in 2012, it was validation that they had put their hands on me. I really needed to write the book for a catharsis.
Terry Lovelace is back. Devil's Den, The Reckoning is now out. Devil's Den earlier was just basically an abduction experience. This is a whole different view. And when you have questions about, there might have been some unresolved issues in that first book, they are resolved pretty much at the beginning, at the outset. But I want to ask first, hey, Terry, I'm glad you're continuing the story.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
What you're talking about here is it makes you a little bit more vulnerable, because this is stuff that, especially with a military background and a public background for your, you know, your own work background, this is where people start to go, well, do you destroy your credibility by coming out with it? Or do you give people more leverage to say something else is going on and we really need to start facing it instead of denying it? Where are you on that spectrum?
Well, you know, I really expected a backlash from my former colleagues and friends in the legal community when I published Incident at Devil's Den in 2018. And that rarely happened. I had a few people call me up and say, have you lost your mind? But for the most part, people were very accepting and even supportive, people I didn't expect to be. With this book, I've had some people from law enforcement unhappy with me for my portrayal of a federal agent. But, you know, this was 1980s, and it's a true story. I'm just telling the truth, and I certainly don't mean to tar everyone with the same brush. I was a prosecuting attorney and enjoyed working with law enforcement, and law enforcement people are do a heck of a job. I am pro-law enforcement. But, as far as Toby goes, that was a wrong path I was sent down.
And this was your buddy. This is the guy you went camping with. And to this day, that's the only camping trip you've ever taken, correct?
You got that right. I have not.
That cured you.
Yes. I'm satiated with camping.
Well, and you address some of the things like from the first book, you know, when you say about the camera, the things that you were going to pack and somehow didn't, even though, you know, there's a discipline of knowing if you're preparing for a routine, then all of this happens. It's almost like rote, you do it, autopilot. And with this trip, there were a whole lot of anomalies.
You know, there were a whole lot of missteps. And Toby and I were just not that inept. You know, I think we were reasonably smart guys. Those missteps should not have taken place. But, you know, in regard to the camera, yeah, I didn't take my camera. I left my camera bag on the kitchen counter, which I can't fathom I did. But, you know, my friend had a camera. Toby had a camera right in his backpack. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we saw that thing, the thought of taking a picture of it never crossed our minds.
Yeah.
How weird is that? It never crossed.
I can imagine. I mean, and really, because that is such a paradigm shift, a mind blow, that the last thing you're doing is saying, well, let's just take back and get a nice view. It's like, holy cow, what now? What now? You know, people don't understand that. This is a fight or flight situation, and you're frightened off, you know, off your rocker, and you're going to take a picture? No. And I'm guessing that even if you had the camera with you and tried to take a picture at that moment, it wouldn't come out. You know how that works.
Absolutely not. You're spot on with that. Absolutely not. You know, I think this speaks to the level of influence that these things can have over us. Because when we first saw this triangular thing take off from the horizon and head in our direction, we should have absolutely been fearful. You know, we were, or even curious. We were semi-sedated, mildly disinterested. I wouldn't say apathetic. But our emotions and our responses were muted. And it was just, like I said, it speaks to their level of influence over us.
Yeah, the consciousness that, okay, and the website, this is terrylovelace.com. So if people are interested in checking out the pictures from the first go-round, you've got them there, the drawing of that triangular-shaped vehicle, vessel, whatever you want to call it, and also the implant that you found in your leg.
Yes, the x-rays are there. And that drawing, by the way, is contemporaneous with the event. I drew that in August of 1977, just a couple months after what we saw.
Just to give yourself a frame of reference?
Yeah, I wanted to preserve it. You know, it's the same reason that I took two-ring binder, notebook binders, and recorded the events that happened. And I kept two logs. I kept one in case I got charged by the OSI with some crime because they were investigating me. And then I kept another that was absolutely candid and, you know, was every detail that I could remember about this craft and what happened to us. And boy, I'm sure glad I did that.
Yes.
You know, documenting that and saving those notebooks was just invaluable to write this book.
Well, and not only that, part of it is that there's a memory, a haze, you know, a fuzz that kind of comes with it. Not everybody has a photographic memory, and especially when you're under tremendous pressure and strain and stress and psychological discombobulation, to go back 20 years after, 5 years after, 10 weeks after, and try and remember it, it gets fuzzy. So this is something I think that gave you a whole lot of ammunition going back and unpacking it. Was that traumatic when you're actually writing it and trying to figure out how to put this out in a way that people are, you know, I guess in sympathy with what happened to you?
You know, that's a great question because, you know, when I saw those X-rays, I never had any intention of telling anyone about this or sharing it with anyone. When I saw those X-rays in 2012, it was validation that they had put their hands on me. I really needed to write the book for a catharsis. I mean, for my own mental health, I really needed to just spew this out and put it in written form. And I'll be honest with you, I expected to sell, you know, 100 books and have 50 in my garage and come to peace with this in some way. And what happened is I sold 30,000 books in 11 countries, and it resonates with a lot of people. I found myself just kind of an inadvertent UFO paranormal investigator, not by intent, but it's just turned into that way. And I couldn't be happier. You know, any friends that I lost in the legal community, I've made up for because I didn't realize that there was such a vibrant UFO culture in this country made up of really good people.
Well, the thing is, when John Mack was researching this and Bud Hopkins, there was, he almost lost his job. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner and then lambasted and criticized and shamed and all that good stuff and finally exonerated. But just for going near this topic, and that didn't make it go away because nobody wanted to hear about it and nobody wanted to believe it, what's happened. And even recently, it was just, you know, in the news in the recent moments, actually, playing the audio from an American Airlines crew that said, we just saw, I think it was a tunnel-shaped or elliptical, oblong-shaped thing that flew above them and past them, and they didn't use the word UFO. But at the same time that they're reporting this, there's footage of one that a helicopter supposedly shot in Brazil that looks very similar to that wingless, you know, white oblong thing that's flying across the sky.
Yeah.
These things are happening, and finally, it's okay to say, what's going on? I saw it. I experienced it. And you're giving people a valid backstory that has all the hallmarks. For one, you had a witness. Two, you had the implant that is in your leg. And then you also have the memory and you wrote it down. So you dialogued, you documented whatever you could to put this in some kind of a concrete framework. That's brilliant. And it's so necessary.
I thought that I was, Travis Walton and I were the only two in the United States that had this issue because I had shied away from the topic. I had not been interested in the topic. I didn't watch Space. I didn't see Independence Day until 2017. You
know? So, yeah, okay, catch up.
Yeah, so I was shocked. Like I said, I put my email address in the back of Incident at Devil's Den and said, if you've had an experience you'd like to share, I'm not a doctor or a therapist, but I'd love to hear your story. I've had over 1,500 people email me. 400 of them, not that I judge anyone's credibility, they're all valid. 400 of them, though, are absolutely incredible. And I took 30 of the best of those stories and shared them in the back of the new book, The Reckoning.
It's different when you're sharing other people's stories in comparison to when you're sharing your own, because people who think they know you or thought they knew you all of a sudden have a different you to reckon with. Back in a few, Wendy's Coffee House, talking with Terry Lovelace. KCMO Talk Radio, Wendy's Coffee House. My guest is Terry Lovelace, author of Incident at Devil's Den and now Devil's Den, The Reckoning. You mentioned at the beginning of the book that your kids are still not quite on board. I mean, not that they don't love their dad, but this is still a topic that isn't quite necessarily mainstream.
It's not, you know, and my daughter is supportive. She's gone with me to MUFON meetings and, you know, man the table and, you know, help me with the books and stuff. But when it comes to the story, she's a scientist by training. She's married to an engineer, you know.
And yeah.
It's just, you know, you put those two together. It's just that's their mindset. That's okay. I don't mind. It's okay. I'm not out to convince anyone of anything. It's like I was in the UFO Congress in Phoenix, and this guy walks up to me and says, "All right, convince me. Convince me you're telling the truth."
Mm.
I'm like, "Look, I don't know how to do that. It's not my job to do that. I'm telling you, you know, my story honestly and without embellishment, and it's totally up to you whether you believe it or not. If you don't want to believe it, that's okay."
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's where people are a little bit, I think, maybe confused that someone's going to force you to believe something. It's like, no, the bottom line is either you believe it or you don't. People tell you their stories, and then you do the due diligence and discernment of, does this work for me? Can I buy into it? Do I believe it? And if you're not ready to believe, that's fine. It might be better that you don't.
That's spot on. That is spot on.
When you said engineer, I just wanted to, you know, for anyone who's connecting with this, John Foster, I've talked with johnfosterufos.com. That's where his site is. He's an engineer. And the fact, I think, certain people have these experiences, he is able to draw these pictures of the craft that he experienced for over 40 years. He's able to draw the beings. He's able to provide some kind of context and very explicit, concrete context for his experiences. You have that same ability, only you have it more as, you know, at this point, you're able to mix and mingle with people and validate their own experiences. It isn't about belief. It's about basically sharing and saying, what if this happened? What if these things are going on? You don't have to believe it, but you become aware of it. And then maybe if you experience it, you'll believe. But that's not the issue. The issue is basically right now, exposure.
Yeah, exactly. Exposure. You heard about that December 8th story in the Jerusalem Post. It made mainstream press here too by Dr. Chaim Eshed. Dr. Chaim Eshed, very well-respected in Israel. He ran their Space Defense Force for 30 years. He was a general, retired, and then taught at university for 10. I have friends in Tel Aviv who told me he's like the Armstrong of Israel. He's just, you know, uber-respected guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the United States, Israel, and a galactic federation, I know kind of sci-fi language, but that's what he said, are in a treaty. And that Trump had planned to make a full disclosure, and the aliens, quote, dissuaded him from doing so. I love the party to that conversation.
Well, then he they have more power over him than anybody else, because he's pretty much in his own man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that making the circuit around the end of December, and I'm. At the same time, you know, see these things like Paul Hillier from Canada, there are some people with some kind of, you know, official recognition who are saying this stuff is happening. But still, the mainstream, our press, doesn't have anywhere to go with it when asking questions. It's like, how do you validate it if they refuse to be seen? Like, you've got pictures on your website of there's images of here. Are these the ET with the big eyes? Is this what you saw?
Oh, the drawings that I made?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, because they have hair.
No, they had, the one that I saw had a wig.
Oh, it's a wig. Okay, I was like, well, on the picture, yeah. Okay, so that's a wig. Okay, well, they're trying to blend in. That was decent of them.
That's a black wig, yeah.
Really?
Black wig and sunglasses, really.
Okay, and then the four fingers.
And then the four long fingers. I think there's a thumb tucked in back of that. But their anatomy is such that it's not visible unless they rotate their wrist in a certain angle.
Okay. So I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Valiant Thor, and this is back from the 50s, 60s, who was supposedly a Venusian and visiting here. And they said the way that, and this is from the ET literature, this, some of this stuff back in the archives, said that the way that you could tell the difference, because he was here with, I think, three others, and they had six fingers. And I thought, why didn't anybody take a picture? Why is there no, if they say they had six fingers, why is there no no reference. And so some of these things that are happening now with experiencers, people are actually coming back and remembering, or, you know, putting some kind of background. And with the four fingers, and you think there might be a thumb, at least you have an image, a drawing. And so that's something that is, I think, relevant. I know it sounds really minuscule, but little details like that, it says that whatever you experienced was real, because you're able to put it in some kind of a memory frame and say, this is what I saw. And then somebody else says, oh, that's exactly what I saw. And we need this stuff to help us corroborate our experiences.
We do. We need validation. That's what we're asking for. You know, I heard that story about the Valiant story. And I went and I looked at every single, I Googled images, every single image that I could find of him. I couldn't find one where his hands were visible.
No. There's one where he's got a side view and his hands kind of there, but not quite. That's what I found. Yeah. Like, all right. Yeah. Okay, so I'm just saying, you know, it's incredible that those little details were not documented. Now, the other thing, too, about that is sometimes we don't know the details are important until later, until after this has happened. And I do think that little Vulcan mind meld thing, whatever it is that they do, where you forget about something, even though it just happened, it's not important. And then you realize, wait a minute, what did I just see? And it comes back. I want to go into your stuff from your past, because this all of a sudden, this is a new page that you have, or maybe a Pandora's box that you opened up about your own experiences prior to this.
It is. I had childhood experiences. As a matter of fact, the chapter about my cousin Gerald, who had experiences at the same time I was having experiences. That was supposed to go into Incident at Devil's Den, and my editor said, you know what, you talk too much about your childhood. You know, people want to hear what happened to you on a camping trip. So he kind of talked me out of including it. You know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the second book, because I thought his Gerald story deserved to be told. He lived in northern Arkansas, and he saw the same thing I was seeing these monkeys in my room as a child.
Yeah.
He saw little clowns. And, you know, I've got letters from people, emails from people from all over the world telling me that, you know, when they were 4 and 5, they have a real distinct memory of this dream they had where there was an owl, a raccoon, a glowing orb of light, a little gray man, clowns, lots of clowns, monkeys. One kid from El Paso, Texas, who I included in the back of my book, it was one of the 30 stories. This kid, and I talked to him, told me that he saw a raccoon on two legs that would come in through his screen as a globe of light and then turn into a walking raccoon that would speak to him with his mind.
Mm.
And very credible kid.
And I believe that that's with the children, that that's more common than we are allowed to, I guess, accept. that it isn't just the imagination. There's something going on, and because the adults can't see it doesn't mean it isn't happening. It means that children don't have a way of a context for giving us something that we will accept as valid. It's just like, that's annoying. That's inconvenient. We don't want to hear about it. Go away. Make it stop.
I had a very nice lady write to me. She says, you know, I had this crazy dream when I was 4 years old that these little men came and they took me on a spaceship. And I can remember that like it was yesterday. And she's 59 years old and said, but I can't remember the Christmases, the vacations, the birthday parties. All that stuff is faded. But man, this dream is as vivid as if I had it yesterday.
Yeah, it's safe, tucked away.
Yeah.
And I had an imaginary friend until I was about 4 and a half. And I told my mom that Hago flew out the window. And that was the last time I talked about Hago. But I know, having gone back and retrieved some of that, that the image I was given was friendly. And it wasn't an E.T. image. It was a little man image. And so it would fit more like a fairy or something like, you know, like that, a gnome. And I thought, you know, why wasn't I afraid? And why did I have this conversation with this being for a few years? My mom didn't, you know, she never really asked me, what does he look like? What is it? Just like, oh, okay, Wendy's playing with her imaginary friend.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we need to start asking better questions and start, stop thinking we know it all and start asking, what don't we know? And you don't know until you start being curious. Beyond abduction to actual contact. And that's what we want to get into. Devil's Den, The Reckoning. Wendy's Coffee House, my guest, Terry Lovelace. As a child, What do you remember?
What I remember is this. I remember that, and in the beginning of Devil's Den, there's a poem that I wrote that really kind of succinctly says it all, but it's too long to read here. I remember they would come into my room and step out of the shadows. And for some reason, they would ask me to go with them. And I would always hesitate. Sometimes I know I went with them. Sometimes I would get scared and scream. But they were always, and it sounds crazy, but they were dressed up like circus monkeys. And I think that that, again, speaks to that level of influence. They can appear in a way that a child will see as most benign. And I thought they were kind of comical, so I didn't see them as threatening. One of the recurrent dreams that I have is the monkey closest to the head of my bed would always hold out a paw, like in a friendly gesture. And for 40 years, I've had a nightmare that's recurring, where I'm back, I'm a child again, I'm in my bed, the monkeys are in my room, and the one closest to me reaches out to me, and instead of a paw, it's four long gray fingers. And when I have that dream, I just flip out. I wake up screaming, and I'll have one every other year or so, but it's still with me.
See, that's the fight or flight. That's our built-in safety net. And because it is so far outside of our template, whatever is built in for us for survival, that says this is foreign, this is scary, this is danger, Will Robinson, danger, and so
danger.
Yeah, you automatically are responding that in your dream. So what, this is the question. When you and Toby have the encounter, Toby says to you when he comes back to the tent, don't you remember? They took us and they hurt us. So this is from childhood. You don't seem to have that same kind of terror that he has.
No, I don't.
Yeah,
I don't. I got to say, and I probably should have said last time, that my temperament's faded somewhat since I published the first book. I don't have the anger anymore that I used to. And I think that that's healthy. And I think that that's genuine. I don't think it was an intentional torture session. They probably could have easily killed us, and they didn't. And I just have this feeling that if I could sit down with them today and say, how you doing? They would say, hey, no hard feelings, man, just doing my job. I don't know if that's kindness that this is, but I really feel that way. I really don't have any resentment against them. And that's a better place to be.
See, I think Travis Walton went through that same thing, because when he first came back and he first started talking, he was frightened. He was petrified. You know what? Whitley Strieber, same thing. All this, the initial contact, the initial, holy cow, this isn't real. This is a nightmare. That initial, and I think reckoning is a good way to put it, is that we can't hide from this. Absolutely cannot hide. And so once you get over the shock and the trauma and the anger of not being given a heads up, a notice, a warning, then it's like, well, you reconcile it. Well, okay, where do we go from here? And I think that's my question of you. I also want to mention real quick before we get into that, there's a document I just found, and it was posted on Facebook and been posted a couple of other places. The CIA download that they did, that dumping of all of the data, but it was sent in at 1947 saying that whatever's visiting us comes from another dimension, not another planet, but it's able to interpenetrate ours. And there's a little bit more that goes along with that, and I'll share that with you. But the thing is that this was being talked about, and it probably came from an experiencer or contactee, and it said, I don't expect this to go anywhere, but this is what I know. And that was one of the things that I thought was really helpful, that we've known these kinds of things in the UFO underground that have to do with other encounters that people are experiencing now, saying this isn't a material or concrete form. This is something that enters in our consciousness or our astral plane and can influence us in the material plane. That's a huge, huge challenge, don't you think?
I couldn't agree more. And I'll tell you, I feel like since 2018, I've had kind of an epiphany, a definite epiphany, and a change of mindset. I remember this craft and seeing it as a nuts and bolts put together thing. I mean, albeit not from Boeing, but it was a mechanical object. And, now I'm not so sure anymore. I'm not so sure it wasn't a living thing, as crazy as that sounds. And my intuition kind of tells me that. And then on a larger scale, you know, could the whole universe be an organic thing?
Yeah. Responding to us.
I know that sounds way out there, but you know, we're just breaking the surface about human consciousness. And I was a psych major in undergrad, and they taught me that consciousness was a sense of awareness. And I had a procedure done and asked my anesthesiologist last year, you know, hey, can you define consciousness for me? You're kind of an expert in that. And he says, sure, it's a state of awareness. Good night.
Yeah. End of story. See, I'm going to get my coffee now.
Yeah, but I don't think we know. And, you know, there's that thing called the irreducibility of the human brain where, you know, you can, people have lost a quarter or a half of their brain. And sometimes intentionally for people with terrible seizures, and they retain their full intellect. Well, you know, if we're a strictly Newtonian physics world, you take out half the brain, you should cut half the intellect across the spectrum in half. And that doesn't happen.
There was something today, it was another thing that was published about, and I can't remember what entity it was, if it was an amoeba or something, that it was disconnected from, slime mold. Yeah, here you go. Just FYI. Single-celled slime mold, no nervous system, and remembers where the food is. Okay, and they're saying, you know, there's no brain, there's nothing. How does that happen? Well, we do the same thing. It's called consciousness.
Yeah, and you don't need a brain to be conscious, I don't think. I don't think so.
I think it's another element. And I think that's what we're, you know, so I was saying, where do we go from here? What are we going to do to go forward? First, I want to get back to the book. Okay, so if you've already read the first one, that's great. You're ahead of the game. Okay, but if you haven't read, and the first one, I'm going to go back to your webpage because all the information with the pictures and all that, that's super helpful. That's terrylovelace.com. Okay, so that's all there. The second one, and that's where you and your buddy, you're just beginning to, you know, the Devil's Den. That's the intro to how what you guys experienced it. But this one talks about your memories of childhood encounters. And so with this, how do you reconcile the two?
Well, you know what? I think that a lot of what I experienced as a child was just dismissed. You know, my parents didn't believe it. My sisters didn't believe it. Although, I got to tell you, my 76-year-old sister, when I wrote this book, said, well, I really don't want to read your book. All I'll say is that, you know, I really am sorry that we weren't of more help to you when the lights would come through the window of the house and we couldn't find you anywhere. And I said, well, you know, I appreciate that. I thought that was a pretty dramatic statement to make.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge. When the lights would come and we couldn't find you anywhere. Light bulb.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you remember being on the ships?
I do. I do, and I have, and I did. And, you know, there's a point where, you know, I'm kind of reluctant to share some of this stuff because it just sounds so incredible. But, you know, I'm determined that I'm going to share it because I think it resonates with more people than it turns off because it's true. And I think a surprising number of people had this experience.
Yes.
I recall being on a ship as 4, 5, 6 years old with a bunch of other kids that I didn't recognize from school or from our neighborhood. And there was a being there that was in charge. It looked like a petite Asian woman. And it was the same woman that I had referred to when I saw her years later. I saw her in 1987, and then I saw her in 2017. And she never aged a day, but she took care of us kids in this like playroom, that big oval, round domed room. And once there was a panel that she could slide open and we could look at the stars, and there were like a trillion stars outside, and they didn't twinkle. And for that reason, I thought we must be in a planetarium or something. Are there Christmas lights maybe?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, stars outside of our atmosphere don't twinkle. They're not filtered through the light. And this woman, this being, would communicate with us telepathically, and we communicated back telepathically. And it felt like the most natural thing in the world. And I recall as a little kid, I asked her one day, why can't we talk like this at home? And she was always very kind to me. And she says, because you're not ready. And I thought, oh boy, I can't wait till I'm 6. I'll be able to do this at home.
Well, I'm going to zip through this.
Yeah. You know, but of course she was talking, I think, about humanity in general.
And of course, there's more to that story. Got to take a quick break. Devil's Den, The Reckoning, Terry Lovelace, KCMO Talk Radio. If you like The Incident at Devil's Den, you might like this one even better.
In Devil's Den, The Reckoning.
We find out now that Terry Lovelace has been having contact since childhood. Other people who've had these childhood encounters remember being told things about the future. Did you get any of that?
Yeah, I did. But I got it more by analogy than I did by words. She showed me a mental image because she could do that. She could project mental imagery, which actually conveys a message every bit as good as verbal communication, with maybe less chance of misinterpretation. But she was talking about Mars and how that humanity would go to Mars. And she gave me the mental imagery of a beehive. And she asked me the mental question, what does a hive do when it exceeds its ability to accommodate its population? And I replied that I think there's a new queen is born, and they go and they start a new hive and break off and branch off. And she said, that's right. And I immediately knew what she meant. She's talking about, humanity's new home is going to be Mars. We're going to be a dual population. What I fear, though, is I also have had the mental imagery, and I don't want to say this, I don't want to say anything that people would find scary or alarmist. That's not the intention here.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the mental picture from the image of the Titanic. You know, who's going to get, if there are bad things in store for the Earth in the future, who's going to get a seat on the lifeboats? Is it just going to be the rich and the privileged? Is it going to be, like the fate of the third class steerage passengers in the depth of the Titanic? I sure hope not. I don't know, but I think we're going to be, Elon Musk says he's going to have 1 million people on Mars.
Yeah.
And 100,000 guy in the next 9 years by 2030.
Before we started talking, you said you've got a project, the next one, and I think it dovetails. It fits right in here. It helps us, the people who've had these experiences, our understanding that we are more than our physical body. And if you repeat what Robert Monroe said years ago, I am more than my physical body. And that's where we're connecting, I believe, with the ET element. Yeah, they can appear to be physical and we can have those experiences, but there's that telepathic thing that I think is a bigger picture of where we're going to progress to and where we need to become more cognizant that is an asset that we need to employ and develop.
Yes, I'm a big fan of the Monroe Institute, and I listen to the Hemisync binaural beats audio at night, every night. And I think that it helps my clarity of thought. It helps me to write. I think it's just good for my soul. We're going somewhere as a species, and I think that there's been a change in mindset. I don't think my book would have been nearly as well received had I published it 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
So I think there is a... some people use the word awakening. I don't know. That's kind of an overused term, but it's kind of descriptive. I think a lot of people are more accepting and more willing to question. And there's so many distractions. It's so easy to focus on sports and the Kardashians and whatever you're watching on Netflix. But a lot of that is distraction, and it keeps us from things that could take us to better directions, I think.
Discovering, exploring, and Robert Bigelow with his consciousness studies that's trying now to, get somebody to come in and say, this is proof of the afterlife. I think he's getting a lot of visibility. People who have credentials, who are under his wing, I think that's what money brings to the equation, is bringing people who are authorities in their field, who will join under the umbrella of we're researching consciousness, we want to know what happens, life after death, that kind of thing. Near-death experiencers are, and people who do, even the psychedelic, magic mushrooms and the LSD trips, ayahuasca, they have these experiences, take them out of this physical and say, oh my gosh, there's so much more here. We haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg with what else is around us that we can't see, that is very much in our presence.
I discuss Mr. Bigelow's challenge and his $1 million prize in my new book. It's going to be called Go Tell the Bees, a Death Analogy. And I talk a lot about bees and the hive mentality and the fact that a single bee can't survive on its own. Had you ever heard the phrase Go Tell the Bees?
No, I hadn't. That's the first time. And I've had beehives, and that's one of my hobbies.
I love bees. And when I was a kid, I went to my grandparents' farm, and they had 10 beehives at the edge of their cotton field. And when my grandfather died, I was 9 years old, I believe. And I went down to the farm, and my parents had left town to go pick up some cousins or somewhere. and my uncles and aunts and my newly widowed grandmother were in the kitchen, and I heard them talking about who's going to tell the beat. And Grandma said, "My job." She took 10 pieces of black cloth and a glass of red wine, and I said, "Can I come too?" And she said, "Sure, you know, just be a good boy and stand back." And I went down and I watched her. She placed a black piece of cotton cloth on top of each hive. And then she set the glass of wine down, kind of in the middle. And then she took a few steps back and she said a prayer. And then she spoke out in a loud voice that scared the heck out of me. And she says, I want you, because of her, she had the country in her voice. She says, "I want you to know that Charles has passed, and his funeral will be tomorrow at Pine Knot Cemetery. And I want you to know that he loved you, and he doesn't want you to go away. That I'll be here, and Kenneth will be here, and we'll still take care of y'all, and you take care of us." And she was, you know, pretty much covered in bees, but walk away from it unmolested. They all went back to the hive.
Yeah.
And there's a cool story from 1956. It's in my new book about Mr. Zepka, Z-E-P-K-A. And it was out of the city of Massachusetts. He was a famous beekeeper. He was well known throughout the entire community as a bee guy. You know, the one that man who had away with bees is what they called him in the paper. At his funeral, as they're lowering his coffin at the gravesite, as they're lowering his casket into the ground, 10,000 bees show up. Didn't buzz, didn't make a nuisance of themselves, but they draped the tent and the tombstone and were silent until a prayer had been finished. And then they en masse got up and went back to Mr. Zepka's farm some miles away. And that's documented by 10 different sources.
Oh, that's beautiful.
What a beautiful story. You got to think there's something more intelligent there than what we see, than what we give credit for.
So the name of your next book?
Go Tell the Bees, a Death Analogy, Anthology, a Death Anthology.
And when is that available?
Probably not until May. I'm only about 30,000 words into it, and I've got some to finish. So I'll have to go through an editor, and then I'll have to get it out. So right now it's just Devil's Den and Devil's Den The Reckoning, both at Amazon.
Okay.
And I'm going to publish this one on Amazon, too. This will be a little different topic. This is a little broader topic, and really I try to address consciousness and death and the interaction between the two and the commonality between UFOs and Bigfoot and near-death experiences and all of it. You know, there's a thread of commonality through all of it that goes back to some common source somewhere.
I like the transition, the progression. Okay, in your face, you cannot hide from this. We're here. And then going back and saying, oh my gosh, they've been here all along. That's just all of this sequence of how we expand our horizons, and you have to kind of go baby steps. So baby steps is like the shock of a lifetime. Oh my God, it's real.
Who'd have thought it? Yeah. Yep.
Terry, I really appreciate your time. I love what you're doing. I really want to talk to you about your next book as well once you're out of the chute with that. So please stay in touch.
I promise I will. I appreciate your time and best wishes to you and your audience.
Terry's books are available on Amazon. The first one is Incident at Devil's Den. And the second one, the one we're talking about now, about his childhood ET experiences, is Devil's Den The Reckoning. I'll put links on the blog at Wendy's Coffee House. And thanks for listening.